From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today we have a conversation with Stephen Marcus, who hopes an art project along Wisconsin Avenue will help invigorate downtown. Then ahead of a big Milwaukee race, we'll explore the appeal of competitive rowing.
What draws you to it then is also the sound of the oars in the water in the morning, seeing the sunrise, sometimes seeing the sunset, and just the amount of hard work that you're putting in with your teammates.
We'll hear about a fair that isn't on most people's radar, but should be. And the English folk rock band The Dunwells really hit their stride in America on their fifth tour.
People are turning up and singing along, which is great. You know, for the first time ever, people are actually singing the words back to us. It's just a great feeling, you know. You feel like you're doing the right thing.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. For more than half a century, Steve Marcus has helped shape the city of Milwaukee. From his role in running the family business, the Marcus Corporation, and its network of hotels, movie theaters, and restaurants, to his philanthropic work, Marcus has had a say in what the city looks and feels like. Steve Marcus passed along the day-to-day operations of the business to his son, Greg, a few years ago, but he remains chairman of the board of directors, and he's able to offer advice based on his decades of business acumen. But now Marcus is turning his attention to an art project he hopes will reinvigorate Wisconsin Avenue and the downtown corridor. Steve Marcus sat down with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke before an audience on the sixth floor of the University Club, and he talked about his vision and how it evolved.
Well, what I see is lining Wisconsin Avenue from the Art Museum, roughly where the DeSouvreau sculpture stands, all the way to about 5th or 6th Street, with what they call monumental sculptures, lining the sides of the streets, using planter boxes that are now on the sidewalks, using spaces like there's a plaza outside the U.S. Bank building, or the Chase Bank building has a very nice plaza for it. There's a space between 4th and 5th on the south side of the street that's now a parking lot that's got room to put a large-scale sculpture there. And I would see perhaps 20 pieces of large-scale sculpture that would be there on a borrowed basis. My first idea was to go buy the sculptures and have them be permanent. But the problem is you'll spend $1 million a piece to do it. Well, that's $20 million. That seemed to be a little bit more than was practical at the time. And then somebody came along and said, you know, you can borrow these. Artists want to get them on display so they can sell them. And it's very hard to find places to do that. And so they'll lend them to you, and they'll probably want them back after 6 months, or maybe when they're sold, whatever the time is, but they would certainly be on display here. And I thought that made an awful lot of sense. The nice thing is, you know, art can sometimes be a little controversial. With this, if they don't like it, it's going to be gone soon anyway, and we'll have to go out and borrow some new art. And my idea behind this is world-class, pretty well-known artists' work. So that people will say, you know, that's a terrific display of great sculptural, large-scale sculptural art. I want to go to Milwaukee to see that. So I view it as an attraction for visitors. I also view it as an attraction for people who are thinking of maybe moving here, maybe trying to find a job here. They call them the creative types, I guess.
You see it as a catalyst.
I do see it as a catalyst. I also see it. I have many friends who haven't been downtown in 40 years. They don't have a clue what's going on in the downtown area. Wisconsin Avenue or any place else, they're missing something. But I see this as being the kind of attraction that they would now come down just to see it, the way they come down to a basketball game right now. They do come down for that, but they don't identify that as even being coming downtown. They come to a basketball game, not come downtown. So I see them, I see them wanting to come down and see what that's about. When they're here, they will walk up and down Wisconsin Avenue from one end to the other. And it will then advise them and inform them that Wisconsin Avenue is not a dangerous place, that it's really a pretty nice place. I wish there was more action on it, but this, if this brings people, in effect, will bring its own action. And so that's important. I want them to feel comfortable being down here. I also think that school groups will have field trips. If they don't have them, I'm going to sponsor some myself. But they'll have field trips into the downtown. Now you get young people in our community, the 8 and 10 and 12-year-old kids, feeling comfortable with coming here. And so that's really the genesis of that project. And I've been very lucky. The Art Museum has agreed to manage the curatorial process, to select the art. The downtown Bid 21 Business Improvement District has agreed to manage the project. And so now all we have to do is raise the money.
From where we're sitting, actually, we're on the sixth floor, the west end of the sixth floor of the University Club, and we can see this downtown corridor. In fact, we can see essentially where Wisconsin Avenue is, and in fact, see both of our offices from here, I think. But just past that, there's a fairly troubled part of town if you keep going north, and there will be some who will listen to this, I suspect, and they might think this would be a wonderful luxury to have adorning downtown Milwaukee, but we have all these challenges in the community: education, public health issues, employment. How would you make the argument that art is more than just a luxury to the city of Milwaukee?
Well, I guess my argument is that if it will help improve the economic base of the community, if it will attract more people to locate offices over on the west side of the river, which is, in that respect, an underdeveloped part of the downtown, and an important part of the downtown. It's the core of the downtown. If it gets sick, everything else will get sick. On the other hand, if it's healthy, everything else will be stronger and healthier. To the extent that you make that happen, you now improve the real estate tax base in the downtown area, and that then gives you the money to spend on taking care of lots of other social issues. And of course, the old saying is, man does not live by bread alone. In this particular case, you need things of beauty in your community for its citizens, for companies that might be wanting to locate here, for young people might be considering moving here. You'd much rather have them moving here than moving elsewhere from here.
You mentioned the idea that that there are some people who their entire experience with downtown today involves going to a basketball game, and they don't even necessarily think of it as coming downtown. They view it as coming to a basketball game. The arena issue, I will put in quotation marks, is somewhat like a lot of the other issues in this community in the sense that there's not necessarily a lot of consensus around it at this stage. What's your view on why community consensus is so hard to accomplish on, say, the idea of a new arena?
Well, I think part of it is because if you think about a whole range of civic assets, if you were to take a vote of our citizens on which one is the most important that we have to have, none of them would really get a majority. They'd get 10%, one would get 12%, another would get 20%. But none would get a majority. The fact of the matter is, though, we need all of those projects. Some we have, but in future years they may become inadequate. They may need to be replaced. Others we don't have at all. We'd like to have them. But the community needs to become involved in a planning process that says, we need a new arena. Yes, we need some new schools. Yes, we need some new parks. Whatever it is, maybe we need a new police station somewhere. Whatever it is, this is what I call civic infrastructure. We've always paid for that out of the property tax. The property tax burden here is crushing. We need to think about a dedicated sales tax for civic infrastructure, not operating costs. For civic infrastructure, And it has to be done pursuant to a plan where the citizens say, through their elected representatives, here is our plan for, let's say, the next 10 years. Here are things we think are the priorities that need to get done. And then take it to the population, say, here's what it's going to cost. Let's say, as Oklahoma City did very successfully, it's going to cost 1% over 10 years. Here are the projects we're going to do. At the end of 10 years, the tax goes away. And up or down, do you want to have it or do you not? And that way, we get a community discussion going on about what things are the most important. What things do we need to do in a time frame? Let's say the next 10 years. Could be 7 years, could be 12 years. Oklahoma City's has varied, but they've done it very successfully. And I'll never forget when I first heard about Oklahoma City, I thought to myself, that's a backwater. Who wants to be there? But then I was dragged kicking and screaming to Oklahoma City to see what it looked like. And it is an unbelievable city. They have had an unbelievable transformation of that whole community. And one of the leading companies there just opened a 56-story headquarters office building there. So they're on the move.
You're listening to Lake Effect. We are on the sixth floor of the University Club, and Steve Marcus is our guest. Your father opened his first movie theater in Ripon, Wisconsin. The movie theater industry has changed a great deal in that time. I gather the theater in Ripon is still open, correct?
Still open, yes.
Given the high costs with running movie theaters today, do you worry at all about what's happening to rural movie theaters?
Well, I do worry about it. Many of them are closing. One of the things that's accelerating that closing, they were always struggling. They were always having a difficult time. And they're so important to smaller communities. I mean, I can't tell you how important the Ripon Theater is, even though it's not profitable for us. But it puts life in their downtowns especially during the nighttime hours and on the weekends. And so they're important gathering places for the communities. But what's happened is as the industry has changed from film and film projection to digital, that conversion costs about $80,000 per auditorium, per screen, and it's being financed right now by the studios. And the studios are reluctant to finance ones that, I mean, they'll finance anything if it will give them the revenue stream needed to pay off the cost of those $80,000 projectors. and so the theaters have to find a way to finance that, and they're having trouble with it. And so many of those small-town, single-screen movie theaters, we believe, are going to go away.
Speaking of single-screen movie theaters, there is one old movie palace still standing on Wisconsin Avenue. The Grand Theater, I believe, happens to be one of your properties for now. How concerned are you with the future of what happens to that building?
Well, I'm very concerned about it. And incidentally, it does have a piece of monumental art on the side of it. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but about 25 years ago, the person who was largely responsible for the development of the Grand Avenue Shopping Center had his office in the Plankinton building, and every time he looked out of his office, he saw a blank wall on the side of what was then called the center building. And he decided that it needed a piece of art there, and he found a way to finance the painting of a trompe l'oeil piece of art on the full side of that building. And if you look at it, it's very interesting. It shows a lot of history of Milwaukee in it.
I will confess, I have seen that and never knew its origins.
Well, that's the origin of it. And I am concerned about it. It is no longer viable as a movie theater. There have been a number of attempts to develop a creative reuse for it. One of the problems now is that there's a very short time period left on a series of leases that encompass that building. It's very complicated. You don't have time to hear my explanation of it. And that's coming to an end. When that is concluded, I believe that there will be a number of opportunities for redevelopment of that particular building. It really is a very historic building. It's a beautiful building. It would be a shame to lose it. My sense is that at some point, once the ownership situation is resolved, that somebody will figure out a way to have some adaptive reuse of the building.
As you drive around downtown Milwaukee, there are a number of high-profile places with the Marcus name on them. As you, as Steve Marcus, view the Marcus Center for the Performing Arts, the Marcus Amphitheater, how do you view your own stamp that you have thus far left on the city of Milwaukee?
Well, I'm not sure I view it as my stamp. It's first of all, it's a function of a local company who has an interest on behalf of itself, and it, but it's more importantly, its customers, it's the people who make up the community, its employees, our associates. That's who it's all done for, and hopefully they find it helpful and makes it a better community for them to be in. And hopefully they view us as being a better citizen for having done it.
I had one question that is perhaps way off the point, but you mentioned something in the breakfast that came before our interview that struck me, and having you here, I wanted to ask it. I gather you own the national rights to the Zaffiro's Pizza name.
Yes.
Does that mean is there going to be a time when you can get a Zaffiro's Pizza in Boston or Phoenix?
I don't have a clue. Those who are responsible for it, which is the next generation, they're going to be the ones who will make that decision. I think they hope so.
Well, Steve Marcus, you have been so generous with your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That's appreciated.
Steve Marcus recorded in conversation with Mitch Tyke on the sixth floor of the University Club in downtown Milwaukee. Marcus is chairman of the board of directors of the Marcus Corporation, the business his father founded in 1935. He was formerly president and CEO of the company, titles his oldest son Greg now holds. Marcus Theaters is the fifth largest movie theater chain in the country, and the company owns 20 hotels and resorts, including the Pfister Hotel and downtown Milwaukee Hilton. The conversation was the first in a series that Lake Effect is doing in partnership with the University Club, and it was recorded in front of an audience. You can hear the audience Q&A at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. A different kind of race takes place here this weekend, the kind with coxswains and oars. We'll learn about the Milwaukee River Challenge next on Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. For the second time in little over a month, some world-class Olympic-caliber athletes will compete in downtown Milwaukee this weekend. In August, it was a USA triathlon event. Well, this Saturday, some of the top rowers in the country, including members of the U.S. national team, will take to the Milwaukee and Menominee Rivers for the 13th annual Milwaukee River Challenge. Alyssa Remington is race director. She talked with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about what draws people to competitive rowing to begin with.
I'd say more and more, actually, it's juniors that are being drawn to the sport. Athletes in high school who may find that time with basketball or other team sports is coming to an end as you progress into a varsity level. And they're looking for some way to stay active. And so they hear about rowing through friends or they see it in the Olympics and they Google it and come on down. And you know instantly whether you love it or you hate it. It's that instant. And for those who love it, it becomes a lifelong sport. And it's more the team aspect of it and the amount of hard work that you have to put in. It really speaks to a very specific kind of person.
Well, lay out that love versus hate thing. What is it that would cause somebody to hate it?
It's pretty monotonous. You do the same motion over and over in order to get yourself up and down a river. In the winter here in Wisconsin, it's even worse because you're doing that same motion on a machine. For us, it's in a basement, and it's 4 hours at a time, and it feels like it's never going to end. But what draws you to it then is also the sound of the oars in the water in the morning, seeing the sunrise, sometimes seeing the sunset, 2 practices a day, and just the amount of hard work that you're putting in with your teammates. You can't explain that connection that you have then to the sport and to the people that are involved in it.
What makes a good rower? What are the kinds of athletes who are not only drawn to it but turn out to be good at it?
A very high level of determination, the ability to focus and stay focused and to push past the pain barriers. That is very important. There's a lot of lactic acid involved, and you have to shut that off and continue beyond it.
So it seems like the equivalent of distance running for your upper body.
That's right, except it's actually not just for your upper body. It's a whole body workout, primarily legs and your back, and then you finish it off with your arms. So while it looks like it's just the arms from the shore, if you're watching people row, it's actually almost like a seated squat where you're using your quads and your back.
Is it important to be tall, big?
It is. It is important to be tall and big. While you can do it while you're small, if you think about the physics of it, you know, you're increasing your lever arm, and the distance and the height really adds to your ability to move through the water.
How hard is the team building coordination aspect of it? I would imagine that, you know, there are some people who could easily get their head around, you know, this is hard physical labor and I have to push through the pain barrier, but I or whoever this is, you have to do it at exactly the same time as your teammates.
You do, and that's what you practice day in and day out. So if you don't match up the timing, you find that it's not that enjoyable for yourself and it might not be the sport for you. So it's what you do, and again, it just kind of becomes part of the sport. You just naturally build as a team.
The thing that's always fascinated me is that there's this other person on the boat, the coxswain, if I'm saying that right.
You are.
What draws somebody to do that?
That is a very special person as well. That is a person who has to be small enough to fit into the boat in this little seat. It's incredibly small. I can speak from experience. And they have to have a certain leadership ability and the ability to command and direct those that are almost twice their size. It takes a very unique person.
Are they motivating them as this is going on?
They are motivating them. I will say that their primary, especially in a race like the River Challenge, their primary job is to steer the boat and to get the rowers safely from point A to point B and in the shortest distance possible. But while they're doing that, on top of it, they are motivating. They are helping to set the rhythm. If something is off within the boat, they have to right the ship, you could say. They are the eyes and the ears of the boat, and they also work very closely with coaches during practice. They're an essential piece. Without them, the boat would not move.
And you say they're steering the boat. How are they actually steering the boat?
They're steering it with a rudder. They have little knobs, and they're attached to a rope, and then that rope goes throughout the boat and connects to a rudder on the underside of the boat. And when they want to go to the right hand goes forward. When they want to go to the left hand goes forward. When you're rowing a shell, you're actually – the rowers themselves are facing backwards. They can't see where they're going. And the coxswain is the only one facing forward. So you, as a rower, put your total faith and trust in this little coxswain to get you safely from, like I said, point A to point B.
Well, so let's talk about the Milwaukee River Challenge itself. This has been around for some time. How has it evolved since it was founded 13 years ago?
Well, 13 years ago, I myself was a participant as a student at the University of Wisconsin. It was a very different race in that it was a two-way race. Head races are where you send boats off one at a time and about maybe 5 to 10 seconds apart, and your goal is to chase the boat in front of you and to not get caught by the boat behind you. So when you cross the finish line, you're not quite sure where you placed, but as long as you haven't let anyone pass you, you know that you're ahead of those boats. This race was strange that you started down in the third ward near the alehouse, and you rode up to the Humboldt Avenue Bridge. There you stopped and turned around and waited for the last boat to cross because this river is very narrow. You can't have two-way traffic. Then once that last boat crossed, then they started again and they sent you back to where you started from. And that is not seen in any other head race that I can think of. Typically what you do is you race as we race today, where we start at 25th and Menominee and we go down in one direction only for approximately 5,000 meters. It's really become a junior-centric event, junior meaning high school age students. It's really evolved in terms of who's participating, but also the numbers. Like I said, there were a couple hundred athletes back in 2001. Last year, we had 650 athletes with 140 different boats. So it has really, really grown, and we continue to see growth.
And I gather there are some national class teams that will be at this?
That's correct, yes. We do try to get members of the national team here every year. It can be difficult in Olympic years, world championship years. But yes, this year we are going to have a presence from the national team. We're going to have an 8 worth of men and a coxswain, so 9 total national team members, those who participated in the recent world championships, also the Olympics, the Pan Am Games. It's a great way to showcase the sport and really show people what you can do with it. The juniors love it. The parents love it. It's really nice.
The course is 3 miles long. Do all the races go all 3 miles?
Yes, all the races go 3 miles. It starts at 25th and Canal. You travel all the way down the Menominee until you get to the junction with the Milwaukee River, where you make a 90-degree angle turn, very difficult in a boat, given their size and limited steering ability. You make the turn, and then you head up to finish the course in front of Schlitz Park.
Talk about the challenge of being a spectator at a race like this. I would imagine everybody would want to be at the finish line. What's your advice to people who want to come out and watch?
My advice is to find a place where you're comfortable. Yeah, you'd like to be at the finish line. It's neat to see people and teams put their boats in the water, and it's also fun to see them sprint it out at the finish. Sometimes there's some back and forth between the boats really trying to race it to the end. But that's not where all the excitement is. We're really lucky here in Milwaukee that we have the Riverwalk that is running half the distance of this course, where you can be anywhere on the Riverwalk and get a really up-close view of these boats. You can also stand on a bridge and see them from above. Most races, you're going to see them from 500 feet away, and they're going to be little specks. You're not going to know who's in the boat. So this is really a special opportunity and way to see rowing that you can't see it at most other rowing events. I actually have to say that one of the most interesting places to watch is at the alehouse, where these boats have to try to take the turn. You see some of the more experienced crews really lining up ahead of time, and that's where they try to pass possibly a crew in front of them that may not have had such a great line for steering, as we call it. Also, given the nature of our course, the number of bridges and the width and the limited width, participants don't have that many opportunities to pass. So it's great to place yourself in a position where you can see them when they can pass. And at the junction, that's a great spot.
What is your dream for this event? Where would you like it to someday be on the rowing map?
On the rowing map, I think I want it to be a premier event in the Midwest, one that is on most people's calendars, their itineraries. We've done a pretty good job. I think we've captured most of the teams in the Midwest. We're on their agendas every year. But it would be neat to get some crews maybe from a little bit further away, those who have to come in the night before and can't just drive in the morning of. There's a big event out in Boston, the head of the Charles, thousands of boats, the largest international regatta. I don't think we'll ever get close to that. But, something like that where we could have vendors up and down the Riverwalk, people lining, the entire course. It would just be spectacular to get people out there, just something for the city to get people to see the river and see all that Milwaukee has to offer.
These rivers are much different from an accessibility standpoint than the Charles is.
Oh, yeah, much, much different. Yeah, you're not walking on a path that was paved by people's footprints. I mean, we have a paved set Riverwalk for more than half of the distance of this course. And along the way, there are restaurants. We have broadcast speakers, a number of these restaurants. It's just the perfect opportunity to witness what rowing is all about.
You competed the first time that this event was held.
I did.
Do you miss those days?
I do. I do miss those days. I've competed a few times since graduating college, actually twice at the head of the Charles. And when you're at these events, you look longingly at the athletes, and then you put yourself in a boat and you try to race and you say, oh, that's right. I'm okay with being done. I'm okay with being the organizer and being involved in a different way. So it's just as fun.
Well, Alyssa Remington, thanks so much and best of luck with the event.
Thank you very much.
Alyssa Remington is race director of the 2013 Milwaukee River Challenge, a rowing competition which follows a 3-mile course on the Milwaukee and Menominee Rivers this Saturday. She spoke with Mitch Tyke, and you can find links to more about the races from wuwm.com/lake effect. Well, it may be fall, but that doesn't mean fair season is over. We'll hear about one coming up in a few weeks that's worth a visit. Lake Effect returns right after this short break on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company. We're more than a month removed from the Wisconsin State Fair, but if you're feeling withdrawal pangs for the fair experience, there's good news for you. We're only a couple of weeks away from the Milwaukee County Fair, and it's right back at the fairgrounds in West Allis, well, at least in the Horticulture Building. You're saying you're not familiar with the Milwaukee County Fair? Stacy Tornio and Ken Keffer talked with Mitch Tyke about it, starting with just when it opens.
It's September 26th through the 29th, and it's one of those things where, you know, a few years back they started saying, hey, Milwaukee County kids and the general public, if they want to enter something into the fair, we don't really have a resource for them. There's county fairs all over the country, all over Wisconsin, and there's not a chance for kids and the public to have that same experience. So they started a county fair here, and it's really cool. I mean, it's a little weird that it's after the state fair, but it's still cool that we can have that experience.
And it's actually at the state fairgrounds, right?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, you can enter things. If you're familiar with county fairs, you kind of know how it works. There's the baked goods. Like, Ken is a baked goods guy. He used to enter baked goods in his county fair. I always used to enter vegetables. There's photography categories. And so there's something for everyone if you want to give it a try.
Well, and I think that's important in a place like Milwaukee County because this is not really a big livestock county.
Right, exactly. There's art that you can do. There's, again, the photography. There's just tons of different categories, the baking, drawing, mosaics. There's gardening. You can enter, you can put together a container and enter that. So it's just like endless categories that you can look at and give it a go.
I think, you know, at the county fair, you got to think beyond the livestock and get into a lot of crafty sorts of activities and stuff, as well as some of the baked goods. You know, I'll have to bring out my old peanut butter cookie recipe and see if I can get another ribbon.
What was your ribbon the first time?
I got a blue ribbon at state. Thank
Ooh,
you very much.
Really?
Nice.
Indeed, yeah. It was also the Wyoming State Fair, so not quite as popular categories. I wouldn't put my peanut butter cookies up just against anybody.
You would think that jerky would be a more competitive category out there. So we generally think of the 4-H Club as being a big driver for county fairs and state fairs as well. How does the 4-H Club figure into the Milwaukee County Fair?
So they do have this. They call it Junior Fair, and that's for 4-H, FFA, and then some organizations, other youth-based organizations. But if you're a part of that, you know that you're part of that. So, like, beyond that, like, if your kid is not involved in that, any kid 8 and up, and there's kid categories and their adult categories, can enter in the open division. And so as long as they're 8 and up, that's it. And the fees are relatively small. I think it's under – you can enter up to 8 items, I think, for less than $10. I'm not entirely sure, but it's not a lot just to give it a try.
And the rules are all in one central repository?
Yeah. You know, you just have to check out. It's through the Extension Office. So you go check out that webpage. They have the booklet for the open categories that explains in detail all the different categories. You know, within the photography subheading, there's different types of photography. So, you know, you need a picture and be like, all right, this is a landscape shot. All of that spelled out there in a little booklet you can just download off the internet.
Aside from the entry fee, what's at stake? Fame and fortune?
Yeah. I mean, there's a little bit of prize money. So blue ribbons, I think, like a few bucks, not much. But my son entered a lot of things last year. And those ribbons, it's that excitement of, like, on fair day, whenever you go to see the ribbons on your work is so exciting for a kid. And he displayed every single one of those ribbons in his room just because it was such a proud moment.
Yeah, and another thing to keep in mind is a lot of these things make great gifts, you know? So if you're a grandparent and you get the prize-winning picture or this hand-stitched pillowcase from your grandson or daughter, that is going to be a possession that gets passed on from generation to generation. So, yeah, there's a lot at stake.
Well, it is definitely something to look forward to, as is your baked goods recipes.
That's right.
So we will be anxiously awaiting the Milwaukee County Fair. Ken, Stacy, thanks again.
Looking forward to it.
Stacy Tornio and Ken Keffer are the authors of the Kids Outdoor Adventure Book, 448 Great Things to Do in Nature Before You Grow Up. They're also Lake Effect's Outdoor Adventure contributors. You'll find a link to more about the Milwaukee County Fair at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll be hearing a lot of in-studio performances on Lake Effect this week. Well, coming up right after the next break is the fast-rising English folk rock band The Dunwells with three songs off their newest release, Blindsighted Faith. Stick around. Lake Effect will be right back.
This isn't how you made it out. You say time's a healer, but I can't forget.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Bonnie North. At the top of the show, we heard an interview with Stephen Marcus. Since 1994, his family name also adorns Milwaukee's Marcus Center for the Performing Arts. The multi-venue complex is home to Eline Hall, Todd Weir Hall, and Vocal Hall under the roof, and to the intimate Peck Pavilion outside by the river. It was in that covered outdoor space that the English folk rock band The Dunwells rocked the town at the end of July. It wasn't the band's first time playing in Milwaukee since they began in 2009, but it was the first time we were able to get them into our studio for some music and conversation. This is the title track from their 2012 album, Blindsighted Faith.
Blindsighted faith. Oh, you love me now. Blindsighted faith.
Feeling.
Blindsighted faith.
Yes, you had your chance.
Blindsighted faith.
I don't love you anymore.
Blindsighted faith.
Oh, you love me still.
Blindsighted faith.
The Dunwells in Lake Effect's performance studio with Blindsighted Faith, which is also the name of their album. And gentlemen, welcome to the show. Such a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Hey, how are you doing?
So let's just go around and introduce yourselves and tell me what you play and sing.
My name is David Hansen and I play guitar.
Hi, my name is David Dunwell. I play guitar and sing.
I'm Joe Dunwell. I play guitar and sing.
I'm Johnny Lamb. I play drums normally, but today I'm on a box. And I sing as well.
I'm Rob Clayton, and I play the bass.
And don't sing.
I do a few oohs and ahs live.
Oohs and ahs and things. Did they keep you in the corner just to play the bass? Yeah. So, fantastic album, gentlemen, I have to say.
Thank you.
Enjoy it. And seeing you live, which is this is the first time I've seen you, even in a studio setting, to do this. Great stuff. So for the audience here who may not know much about you, you're from Leeds.
Mm-hmm.
And you're on sort of an American-Canadian tour. Is that what's going on right now?
We are just coming to the last week, actually. We finish this tour on the 4th of August at Lollapalooza. It's a 7.5-week tour, so we're coming up to the last week.
Anxious to get home?
Looking forward to getting home. We've had a great tour. This has been one of our favourite tours to do. We've done 5 American tours, and we're figuring it out.
It's festival time, so there's great stages that we're playing across America and Canada. So it's been a really good for playing to big crowds and having great gigs.
Now, Blindsighted Faith came out, 2 years ago?
Released under Concord Records August last year. So we've been touring it since then.
How are people responding? Are you getting more airplay? People starting to know who you are better?
Yeah, and people are turning up to the shows, and especially with radio play of I Could Be a King, the single that we had. People are turning up and singing along, which is great. You know, for the first time ever, people are actually singing the words back to us.
How does that feel?
It's just a great feeling, you know. You feel like you're doing the right thing.
One of the things I love about listening to your music is I can tell you've all listened to things from like the 60s and 70s, particularly your harmonies. There's a lot of Crosby, Stills, and Nash I hear in there, that influence, that kind of very tight harmony. We're going to hear that in the song in the middle. But yet you guys are not covering you're doing your own writing, which is also very cool. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the influences? Am I naming the correct influences, or are there others that are more?
I think the Crosby, Stills and Nash, the harmonies are just natural to us because me and Dave are brothers, and Johnny grew up in the same town, or just about outside the same town that we live in. So we've always sung together. I don't think we've intentionally gone out there to sound like Crosby, Stills and Nash, but it's great to have these comparisons, you know, to be said that, you know, our harmonies sound similar. As a band, we've all got such different influences. Like, I'm into Radiohead and an English Manchester band down the road from us called Elbow, and Rob's into Biffy Clyro and Brand New, and more rock than country and folk.
I like your quintessential English bands like your Coldplays, but I also love my American rock as well, like Counting Crows. And I think, as Joe says, we've all got such eclectic tastes, different. We all love different music. None of it was intentionally brought. You know, we never decided this is how we're going to sound. We just brought all of our influences in.
And this is what happened. All, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Dave, I can hear you're really into the blues, because I was listening
That's
to
right.
you warm up.
Yeah, I really like John Lee Hooker and Buddy Guy, Joe Bonamassa maybe, you know, mm-hmm. more contemporary blues players. But yeah, the blues is the thing that I listen to, being a guitar player, you know.
Well, and I just like the fact you've got the three guitars all doing interesting things, but then the bass is also melodic as well. And then I'm not leaving you out, Johnny, I promise.
Oh, that's cool. I'm just waiting.
Yeah. But, you know, you know, like Phil Collins, a drummer who sings, but also I can tell even just on the box, there's a lot of interesting rhythms and things that are going. It's not just beating out of time, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I just kind of go with it. It's one of them things. There's no real. I studied drums for a little bit, but I never got that far with it. So I just kind of do what I do, and then if it's not good enough, he'll tell me.
Well, most of the songs are written on just an acoustic guitar, so they've kind of got free rein to add that flair that the song needs, do you know what I mean?
So when you all get together and you're rehearsing and you bring a new song in, everybody is part of the arrangement?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So do you consider yourself all the songwriters, or...?
Mm-hmm. Every song's got a different story, but we definitely all arrange the songs together, you know. We don't think we all respect each other as musicians, and especially in the areas. I mean, try my best not to tell Johnny how to play a beat, because he can play many. He's got a better mind to think about beats and patterns than we do. The arrangement's very important that we're all in the room together.
So what about the songwriting process for you? You know, do you just stuff just come? Do you go off and do you try to do concentrated songwriting bursts? How does that work?
Every song's different, you know, like song like Only Me, that was completely written by Johnny, but I had a chorus that kind of fit that song, so we stuck the two together and it just seemed to work, you know. And then this song's like on the album Elizabeth, it has been around for 5 years before the band even became a band, and then songs like I Could Be a King and Blindsided Faith were written during the first album process, and every song's an individual, and because we're working on the second album now, it's becoming more exciting as well.
Because we tour so much as well, I think that we've all learnt how to kind of take our guitars into the hotel rooms and carry on the writing process as well. So I think you've got to utilise this time that we're all together.
Yeah, you said in one of the songs, I am forgetting which one, it might have been Follow the Road, you were in Texas when that all finally came together. So like it sounds like the road itself feeds the songwriting process for you.
You can say that, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the riff Dave Hansen had for, I don't know how long he had it before he actually showed us guys, but he had the riff, and then we were on a trip up to Edinburgh, and I was driving and Johnny was at the front and Hansen got the guitar out at the back, and he played us this riff, and we all started singing Follow the Road, and, you know,
it sounded very different then. And then when we went to go and record the album in Austin, Texas, that's when it got that bit of a Texas flair to it there. It got finished up there.
That little bit of drive, yeah, that yeah. sort of, you yeah. know, American drive to it. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, you mentioned the song Only Me, and a breakup song, a love song.
What it was really late at this party, and everyone was starting to fall asleep. And then me and one guy were just sat up with a guitar, and it kind of like all the verses and things like that just came out in one go, but someone was recording it, so I got the recording back and then wrote down what I said and didn't really change anything. And then Joe came up with
the chorus, the things are getting easier now, was just a few lyrics. Like, it was just an idea. I didn't actually know where it was going to go or what it could go to. And then Johnny, we were in Durham, Newcastle, just writing down some demos. Oh, no, we were on tour at the time. We were doing, like, a coffee shop tour. And Johnny went, well, I've got this idea. And I went, well, that's in the same key that I've written this. It was just kind of something that happened.
Well, let's hear it. This is the Dunwells in Lake Effects Performance Studio.
And every time I'm crying, and every time I'm crying, I think of you. I'd rather be escaping, rather be escaping from the truth. It's only me I'm blaming, it's me who changed the lanes and crashed down hard. So hard. But things are getting easier now. I won't break out, my love. And every time I'm running, and every time I'm running, I run to you. I'd rather be escaping, rather be escaping from the truth. It's only me I'm blaming, it's me who changed the lanes and crashed. It's only me I'm drinking, only me that can't realize. Things are getting easier now. I won't break out, my love. Things are getting easier now. I won't break out, my love.
That was the Dunwells with Only Me in Lake Effects Performance Studio. Again, beautiful, beautiful harmonies. And that is something that a lot of bands don't do. It's that really kind of close harmony. And I tend to think of it as way back, like doo-wop type singing, where everything is just so close and so tight. And I love it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good stuff. So second album coming out. You working
it's
on it?
Working on it. You know, it's an exciting time for us. We've got one album, the first album, which Blindsided Faith, which we are mega, mega proud of. And that's kind of the catalyst or the starting point for what the Dunwells is. And we've got 5 tours under our belt. And, you know, we're looking to always move forward.
Same kind of tunes that are going to be on the second album? Or is it too early to talk about yet?
I think it's too early to talk about.
Yeah.
There's a few good ideas that we're kind of road testing, playing our live shows. And that kind of gets us all excited about the new writing process and getting the new songs in. But I really feel like we could go any direction with this band. Being 5 individuals who like to write songs, we could go in either way. And I find that quite exciting, really. So a bit too early to talk about.
Okay. But are we going to hear some of the new things tonight?
Yes.
Oh,
like,
good.
Yeah, quite a few of them, yeah.
Oh, good.
Because we've been on tour, we've got told that we were playing, like, hour and 20 minute sets, hour and 30 minute sets. So we had to actually write some more stuff to actually fill out these hour and a half sets. I don't know if they're good or not, but
yeah, and make sure you have enough for encores and all of that kind of stuff.
We didn't want to do covers, so we started to, you know, we just kept on writing.
Have to keep writing. Have crowds been good? People been liking stuff?
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, really good.
Good, because it's amazingly infectious music. Really enjoy listening to it. I've kind of burnt, if you can wear a CD out, I have. But I can't thank you enough for coming in and playing for us and talking with us a little bit. And I hope the next time you're in Milwaukee, you'll stop back.
We will. Absolutely.
Thank you.
And the new album will be out then, maybe.
Yeah,
and we'll hear some of the new things that we'll hear. Those of us who are going to go to the concert tonight will hear.
Yes, so, we will, yeah.
Very cool. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Face the truth, life is up to you. Just go forward. Find your feet, my friend. Time heals everything. Just go forward. As the sun goes down, we carry on regardless. Arms are open wide. Fight the urge to cry.
The Dunwells performed Follow the Road in our Studio C1 at the end of July. The band members are Joseph Dunwell, vocals and acoustic guitar, David Dunwell, vocals, piano, guitars, and banjo, Johnny Lamb, vocals and drums, Rob Clayton, bass and vocals, and Dave Hansen, lead guitar, vocals, and pedal steel. You can hear all three songs they played for us, Blindsided Faith, Only Me, and Follow the Road, in their entirety at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Thanks to John Strzelecki for engineering that concert. I'm Bonnie North, and thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now. Fresh air is next.